William to the rescue. William had always been interested in the spy question, and a sensational spy trial had recently roused his interest still further. "Coo," he said to his family one morning. "Just fancy that, a Russian coming over and living ordinary in a cottage, same as anyone else, and all the time drawing aeroplanes and such like. I bet, really, about every other person's a spy, if only we knew it." "Do stop talking so much, dear," said his mother, "and get on with your breakfast."
"Yes, shut up," snapped Robert.
William looked at Robert curiously.
Funny that Robert should get so mad at him for talking about spies. Funny him snapping at him like that if he hadn't got a guilty conscience.
He decided to watch Robert very carefully.
Robert was certainly being odd in his behaviour.
He'd been hurrying out of the house directly after breakfast with a tense look on his face and not reappearing till lunch. He would stay in his bedroom for long periods, then sally forth, shining with cleanliness and hair oil, and dash off to some unknown destination. Later that morning, William followed Robert to a small house just outside the village that had been let for the summer months to a family consisting of a father, mother, and two daughters. Robert knocked and was admitted by the elder of the two daughters, a pretty girl of about 17. He looked flushed and sheepish and painfully embarrassed, but was obviously trying to make a good impression. William watched with scorn and disappointment. But as he turned away contemptuously, an idea struck him. Perhaps the girl's father was a general or an admiral or something, and Robert was worming his secrets out of the daughter. He decided to hang about. Soon the front door opened, and the younger daughter, a girl of 13, came out eating an apple. She was a large, sturdy girl, and wore her hair in two long plaits.
"Hello," said William, in a propitiatory manner.
She looked at him dispassionately and took another bite of her apple without answering.
"I say, it's nice for you having a father in the army," went on William, with what he fondly imagined to be a masterstroke of finesse. The girl took another bite and still stared at him without answering.
No, it's the Navy he's in, isn't it?"
She continued to eat in silence.
"Now I come to think of it," said William, "I believe I heard he was in the Air Force."
The girl took yet another bite. Then she said, "Dad's a dentist, and if you don't stop hanging about our front gate like that, he'll come and pull all your teeth out for you." William shuddered. The girl finished the apple with one large bite. "You buzz off," she said. "My dad's got his drill with him, and..." But William was already turning the corner of the road. It was disappointing. Still, he was loath to give up his suspicion entirely and decided to make a thorough search of Robert's bedroom. The drawer of Robert's writing desk was full of papers. But after studying them for some time, he realised that the almost illegible scrawl that covered so many sheets was abortive attempts at poems in praise of the beloved, and that what he had at first taken for the plan of an aerodrome was really an attempt at a sketch of the beloved's profile. He replaced them carefully, but his fingers were in their usual condition. He went next to Ethel's bedroom. He knew that beautiful women were generally spies, and although he did not consider Ethel beautiful, he knew that many people did. In the bottom of her wardrobe was a box of chocolates, and William sampled one tentatively in order to find out if they were poisoned. Finding that they were not, he went on eating them absent-mindedly until the box was empty. He then examined her scarves and gloves, upset a box of powder by mistake, experimented with her rouge, and upset a bottle of eau de cologne. He then went quietly out again. Ethel would never realise that her things had been disturbed. He would probably have forgotten all about the spy question had he not gone with Ginger one half-holiday afternoon to the pictures at Hadley. The film held him spellbound from beginning to end. It was about a spy, a large, fat spy with a round, jolly face and a jovial manner. He wore spectacles and had a head that was completely bald, except just at the back. No one dreamt that he was a spy. All William's vague suspicions leapt to life once more.
I bet they're everywhere, all over the place, he said to Ginger on the way home. I bet all those jolly sort of people you meet are really spies. Shouldn't be surprised if that dentist isn't one. And there's Robert going there every day. I bet they're either training him to be a spy or getting his secrets out of him somehow. He decided to keep his eyes open. He'd look out for fat, bald men with jovial manners.
William, dear, said his mother as he sat down to his tea, I do hope you'll be on your best behaviour this evening. A friend of your father's is coming to dinner. It's a very important visit, and your father particularly wants you to behave well.
William groaned. He knew the dullness of these important visitors and the gulf that yawned between his conception of good behaviour and that of other people's.
Who is the chap, anyway? Put in Robert, who was standing in front of the mantelpiece, studying his reflection in the mirror and trying to solve the eternal problem of whether he was good-looking or not.
Well, I don't understand business, of course, said Mrs. Brown, but it seems he's a director of the Dodo Copper Mine in Rhodesia, and they've struck a very rich deposit of copper or something. He's letting just a few people have shares in it, so you see, it's very lucky indeed for your father to have been put in touch with this man.
But William wasn't listening. However, when the visitor arrived, William lost interest in everything else, for the visitor was a large, fat man with a round, jolly face and a jovial manner. He wore spectacles and had a head that was completely bald, except just at the back. Here was the villain of the film miraculously come to life. Here was the arch spy under his own roof. It would be terrible if he let his prey escape him, now that he had him in his grasp. He glanced over his adversary's person. He probably had some of his stolen plans concealed on him somewhere. That pocket looked rather bulky, and so did that one. And he carried a promising-looking attaché case. Mr. Fletcher greeted Mrs. Brown and William, then went into the study with Mr. Brown. William hung about outside the door. He applied his ear to the keyhole. Isolated phrases reached him in the visitor's fat, unctuous voice.
Only too happy to let you in on the shares. Same belt, probably, as other Rhodesian mines, but much richer. Immediate funds necessary for machinery, etc. No time to put them on the open market. Naturally wish friends of mine to have first chance. These £1 shares will, in a year's time, be worth at least 20.
So it was just business, and the fat man evidently wasn't a spy after all. There was a little more conversation. Then William applied his eye to the keyhole again and saw his father write out a cheque and hand it to the visitor. He was turning away in disgust when a phrase arrested his attention.
Don't forget, Mr. Brown, I'm letting you in on the ground floor. This is your great opportunity to get in. America is already interested. There's a ready market there.
William gasped with excitement. The man was a spy. He was, moreover, persuading his father to be his accomplice, saying he'd let him in to the ground floor of some government building, through a window, probably, to steal some plans, which they were then going to sell to America. His father was in the hands of this villain and must be saved at all costs. William heard the drawing-room door open. His mother came out. He at once pretended to be deeply engrossed in the umbrella stand.
"What are you doing, William?" said his mother. "I'm just wondering whether I could make one of these. I bet I could, with a saw and a bit of wood."
"Well, it's your bedtime, dear, so never mind about that now. Go to bed very quietly, because I don't want your father disturbed. He's having a most important talk."
William went slowly up to his bedroom. He waited till he heard the sounds of his mother, his father, and the visitor going into the dining room, and when the coast was clear, he crept downstairs to the hall. Yes, there was the visitor's attaché case just by the umbrella stand. He snatched it up, crept back to his room, and sat down on the floor to examine the contents. They were disappointing. Letters about copper and pyrites and copper sulphide and copies of meaningless telegrams. He tossed them on one side. Downstairs, dinner was already over. Mr. Fletcher was evidently in a great hurry. He could not, it seemed, even stay for coffee. His case. Where was his case?
There was general confusion as everyone began to hunt for it. They searched everywhere. The visitor's unctuous laugh grew a trifle less unctuous, and a note of anxiety invaded it. A sudden idea struck Mr. Brown. He went upstairs to William's room. William was on his knees in the act of bundling the scattered papers back into the case.
"Give me that at once," said Mr. Brown sternly,
and added on a sinister note,
"I'll deal with you later, my boy."
Before William could protest, his father snatched up the case and descended the stairs. William heard him explaining to the visitor that the case had been taken upstairs by mistake, heard with a sinking heart the last genial farewells and the closing of the front door, and then, with a heart that sank deeper still, the sound of his father's footsteps briskly ascending the stairs.
"Disgraceful!" exploded Mr. Brown. "Utterly disgraceful! Prying into the possessions of a guest in your own house! Have you no sense of honour? You need a lesson, my boy, and I'm going..."
Just then, his eye was caught by a piece of paper just under William's bed. He stooped and picked it up. It was one of the meaningless telegrams which William in his haste had omitted to put back into the case.
"And this, I suppose, is one of his papers. It may be a most important one. He may be suffering serious inconvenience from the loss of it, and all because my son is so devoid of a sense of honour as to...
His voice died away. He was studying the paper with interest. The mysterious telegram now interested him far more than William.
"What's this? Dodo, Northern Rhodesia. Regret confirmed. Deposit petered out. Stop. Diamond drills. Proof conclusive. No hope. Restrike. Stop. Await your cable advice when make failure public. Stop."
"What's the matter, dear?" said Mrs. Brown, as her husband came rushing downstairs, followed by William.
"Matter?" shouted Mr. Brown furiously. "The matter is I've been stung. Or rather, I should have been stung if you hadn't had a rascal and a ruffian for a son. Thank heavens, there's time to stop the check."
He tried to assume an expression of severity.
"Now, let this be a lesson to you, my boy. I mean, it's turned out all right this time, as it happened, so I'll say no more about it, but..."
At that moment, Robert and Ethel entered tumultuously. They'd just found the traces of William's spy investigations. Now they'd come to lay their complaints before authority. "He's been into all my things," said Ethel.
"My most private papers," said Robert.
"There simply isn't anything he's not messed about and left upside down," said Ethel.
"Marks all over my collars.
My scarves ruined. Filthy finger marks all over everything." They stopped and waited with complacent certainty for Nemesis to overtake the culprit. Mr. Brown looked up absently from the telegram.
"Yes, wash your hands before you do it again, my boy," he said mildly to William. "People don't like dirty finger marks on their things."
Robert and Ethel stared at him open-mouthed. "But, Father," they began simultaneously.
Yes, said Mr. Brown testily. "Yes, I heard what you said. Run along now. I'm very busy. I have to ring up the bank manager at home."
William had gathered breath to enter into one of his lengthy self-justifications, but he let it out again. He didn't understand what had happened, but he did understand that retribution seemed to have been miraculously averted from him. "But I don't understand," said Mrs. Brown. Mr. Brown told them in a few short, pungent words what had occurred. "Oh, how clever of William," said Mrs. Brown.
"Clever!"
snorted Robert and Ethel simultaneously. "Tell me, dear, what..." began Mrs. Brown, looking round for William. But William wasn't there. He was in bed, and apparently asleep.